You want prizes? We've got free prizes. You want cash? We've got lots of cash. Simply download Bashani Radio app. Allow push notifications and listen for your chance to win loads of cash. Please don't tell our CEO it's his money we're giving away. We won't tell if you won't tell. Bashani Radio app. Download it for free in the App Store.
Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
You are now tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio. Always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, author of the 12 Universal Laws of Success. I am your transformational speaker and trainer. We've written 8 books, had our books translated into many languages, but we are now engaged in transforming the lives of 10 million people, helping them be what they want to be, do what they want to do, and have whatever they want to have. If you would like to attract health, wealth, happiness, love, success, prosperity, and money into your life, you are in the right place. I would also like to thank our listeners for making the Millionaire Mentorship Show the number one new program on Bashani Radio with over 2.5 million listeners. With listeners like you, nothing is impossible. So keep up the good work. Keep on listening, sharing, and subscribing. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, and you know, we're going to be doing a special section of the Millionaire Mentorship Show over the next few weeks. And this is a section called Daddy-Daughter Dialogue with my daughter, Olivia Harris. And we'll be dealing with political, social, racism, and some of the other current events going on. Today, this is part 2 of a daddy-daughter dialogue that we started last week, where we are talking about the impact of integration on businesses in the Black community, and that transaction or that transformation period from a segregated business to an integrated business community. So now, back to our discussion with my daughter, Olivia Harris.
You know what I find very interesting? I love that you said the emotional level, because when I think about business, when we talk about business, I used to think of business as a very, kind of the way I used to think about white people, which is like out there doing stuff, like not understandable, like very far, you know, in a way distant from me and not attainable to make sense of. And, you know, when I got to college and as I started to, you know, Columbia has a huge business school, and I would do some of their participant, they had these like, they would do these tests and stuff, and they'd pay you money to do one of their tests. And the tests were always very simple. Like, we're like, you know, pick this thing, and we'll give you, a minute to do it and see how many of these things you can do. And what I started to learn from that was that I was like, this is the business department? And what I realized is so much of business is behavioral. So much of business is subconscious. Yeah. And I actually once heard Tony Robbins say, business is actually a spiritual game.
Mm. Yes.
And when we look at business from the perspective of, if you take the money, if you put the money aside, that you really interact with what the actions of business are on a day-to-day basis. There's making the product that you're selling, whatever that might be. And then there's all the other stuff, which is so interpersonal, convincing people that it's worth buying, you know, convincing people to join you in some way, shape, or form. And as a consumer, why do I choose this restaurant over that restaurant? Maybe I like that type of food better. You know, maybe I like this food from this place, or but then let's say that it's two burger joints. I'm picking between Burger King versus McDonald's. Why am I picking McDonald's versus Burger King, right? And so much of that is subconscious. So much of that is my personal opinion about the French fries. Like for me, why I choose McDonald's over Burger King is the French fries.
Yes.
And my memories of going to McDonald's.
Yes.
But if I had grown up eating Burger King fries and being like, Burger King fries are the best, and eating with my friends, would I be choosing Burger King? Maybe.
Yeah.
Right? So as I think about that, like on that micro level, the microscopic level of my personal choices, and then you zoom out a bit to think about the macro part of race as it plays out for a consumer. You know, who, what does business mean to me? What do I think business is? What do I think a business that I consume, what do I think they should be doing? How do I think they should be acting? And how much of all those things is tied into race?
Yes. Yes.
And that's like writ large, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, someone once said that the black population of America, if we looked at our buying power, our spending power, would be like as big as, a country. Some countries in the world would be bigger than some countries in the world. When we look at integration, it seems that in America, the profit motive is the predominant driving force, and that we've gotten away from the moral motives. So we go to church and God says, there's a God and the golden rule, you know, treat your brother as yourself. And then you have, for example, the bus boycott. That's an economic assault. When when Rosa Parks refused to go to the back of the bus and she was arrested, the black people decided that they weren't going to ride the bus. And for a whole year, they made other arrangements. The white people looked at the bottom line and said, hey, we're losing money.
Right.
It is an economically bad decision to continue this.
Right.
And so let's let black people, let's let colored people sit wherever they want. So there was no moral revelation. It was an economic revelation. And I think that was a lot of the driving force in segregation, that in integration, that at some point the business community, especially in the South, saw that there was a whole market out there that they had given up by segregation. That there were people who wanted to eat in the restaurants. That there were people who wanted to buy certain cars, that had up until that time during segregation, they couldn't do it. And so over that period of time from the 60s into the 70s, what happened is as integration began to spread, black businesses could not compete with the white businesses. Once again, because of racism, lack of capital. I remember the cab company, they didn't get a loan from the bank to go out and buy 6 cabs or 10 cabs. They saved their money, they made their money, and they had one cab, and the guy drove it all the time himself, and then he got 2, and then he got 3. And so when you bring up an economic system predominantly in the black community that was undercapitalized, that functioned out of need, black people needed to ride in cabs, so we had black cabs. Black people needed to eat, so we had black restaurants. one of the bastions and the early black millionaires were made in an area that white folks had completely given up. They didn't mess around with black hair. Madam C.J. Walker, Addie Malone, there were the first wave of black millionaires in this country came predominantly through the hair care products, through beauty products for black people. I mean, you look at Miss Malone, there was a company, I think her company was called Apex. She had over 40,000 representatives. She was doing, I think, like $12 million a year when that was real money for her company. She had beauty schools all over the country. She was actually had branches in Cuba and other countries. I think the white business community looked at the black community and they're like, wow, there's a whole bunch of, there's a whole new market out there that we have given up because of segregation. Mm-hmm. If we now permit integration, financially, I think the white world benefited more from integration economically than the black business world did.
And I wanna, this is perfect, as my mother would say, stick a pin for a moment. Because there is a, I think the real interesting thing is when you really look at what, when you say integration, what got integrated into what? And I look, and I when I look at it, I see that black consumers got integrated into white businesses. I see that black culture got integrated into American culture. Like, oh, James Brown is music for everybody. You know, Michael Jackson was like one of the biggest pop stars ever. And it's like his, he, you know, taking black styles and putting them large and then, you know, sharing that out to the world became America. Like when people outside of America, they're like Michael Jackson, Coca-Cola, you know, they put them together. Like that became, or rather Michael Jackson, Pepsi, because, you know, is his commercial. But also that black students got integrated into white schools.
Yes.
Right. And then I think, as you said about capital, black capital, which had never been available before. When you think about that, black capital was never available to white people.
Right.
And suddenly that too became a part of the banking system.
Yes. You know, Olivia, you just hit a point. How was integration interpreted? So think about this. In Wilmington, North Carolina, and I'm pretty sure everyone I've ever interviewed for our book, the same thing happened. The same school systems that fought integration. So we had the Brown versus the Board of Education in 1956. The schools didn't integrate in Wilmington, I think, until 1968.
Yeah.
And most of the places throughout the South, the same people who fought integration were still in charge after the court order said you had to integrate. So now they didn't, all of a sudden, since the court order said you had to do it, they didn't have a moral recapitulation. They then interpreted integration as perpetuation of their white mindset. Most of the black schools were closed. The white kids did not come to the black schools. All the integration always went the other way. The black kids went to the white schools. Many of the traditionally black schools were torn down. And not only torn down, but torn down disrespectfully. Mm. In Williston, one of my old teachers was sharing how he, when integration took place after 1968, he happened to be passing by the school and he saw the dumpster outside and they were literally taking stuff out of the school office, yearbooks, trophies that had been, you know, that the black kids had won in the different athletic events, were literally throwing it into the trash as though it had no value. And he contacted, they didn't have cell phones, so I guess he had to go to the corner and call on the payphone. But he got other people, yeah. They went through the dumpster and tried to salvage some of the history the yearbooks. Like when my class, we had to find somebody who had one to get it reprinted, to salvage the yearbooks, to salvage the things that were of value in the black schools. And so the power structure interpreted integration as bringing the black into the white, but giving no value at all to the black.
And it's so honestly, for those of you who were with us last week, it is a perpetuation in my perspective, from my view, of cultural hegemony.
Yes.
It is a way of continuing to say that white things are better. In fact, they're so much better that everybody wants them. So we're going to make sure, apparently we have to give you it because everybody, that would be fair. So we're going to give everybody access to white stuff.
Yes.
Nobody was like clamoring for kente cloth. Like it was not a clamoring for kente cloth. There was no run on, you know, on textile.
White cloth. Yeah. But you know, it sounded interesting, Libby, that as those schools were integrated into, as the white black students were integrated into the white schools, I think that began a lot of the diseducation and the disintegration of purposeful education in the black community. Now, I'm not going to negate it all, because over the last, especially the periods of the late 60s, the 70s, the early 80s, the black students, I think that was during a period you had more black men in particular in college than in prison. But now, today, I think it's just the other way around. We have more black men in prison than in college. And so the system has not really changed. That same paradigm of racism continues to manifest. It just takes different clothing and different clothes, but it continues to manifest. And one of the diversions I wanted to go in, I used to be, when I worked for Reverend Ike, we were involved a lot with the black hair products, the beauty products companies, Johnson Products, Dudley Products, American Beauty Products, the Donnie Curl, and a lot of the black hair products companies were trying to go public. Proline, Gomer Cottrell. I mean, these all men were millionaires. Remember, Mr. Dudley was doing, I don't know, $20 million a year in sales. These were millionaires, and their companies were employing black people all over the country. Revlon and other beauty products companies literally gobbled up all of those companies. And so now, there are almost no, you might say, black hair products companies, major companies left. Even Mr. Dudley, he did his best to maintain his operation. His distribution model was different. He distributed his products through the beauty parlors. He would never go the route of the other hair products manufacturers. They wanted to get into the big box stores. Now, think about that. That's that racism again. I need to be in the big box stores. Mr. Dudley said, my customers come to get their hair done in the beauty parlor, so I don't need to be in the big box stores. I'll just have it there when they come to get their hair done. And that worked a long time. Mm-hmm. But competition is so deep, as the other companies begin to get bought up, then even your beauty products companies start going other places to get their supplies. Mm-hmm. Once again, integration benefited the Revlons and the white, we might say the traditional companies, because it gave them access to a market that had been traditionally black. Now that market is gone. Wow, Olivia, this is a great place to take a pause for the cause. So folks, we'll be right back after some words from our sponsors. Hey folks, this is Dr. Herbert Harris, and I want to invite you to become a part of the Success Mentorship Network. This is a website and a membership site where you can get access to many of my videos and audios on how to become successful, how to overcome procrastination, how to overcome lack of focus, how to pick yourself after you've been knocked down. Go to our website, Patreon, www.patreon, that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/Success Mentorship Network. That's patreon.com/Success Mentorship Network, and join the Success Mentorship Network and turn your life around. You are tuned in to the Bishani Radio Network, coming to you from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. And now, back to our program. Once again, institutional cultural racism, as you call it, hegemony, hegemony.
However that word is said, it's just an interesting, well, I think as African Americans, as someone who's the daughter of an immigrant to America and who grew up in a niche community, like a really specific community where it was majority immigrant community, primarily Caribbean people of every stripe, you know, like, and if you, depending on who you are, you might say that even Puerto Ricans and Dominicans are a part of the Caribbean culture as well. We share a lot of the racial background in terms of, we share a lot of the same needs, we share a lot of the same food. Like, you know, like if we go to the store, we have a really similar makeup, right? Like we're gonna go buy plantain and, you know, we're gonna, you know, do straighten our hair and we're gonna, you know, yeah, like we have a lot of things in common. Maybe you might not say we're exactly the same, but for in terms of our archetype, our what we look like as a consumer. Mm. Now, you know, I say that because there are a lot of groups that are not African American in the United States. There are a lot of them. There are a lot. Our country is made up of immigrants. And, you know, and some more recent than others, you know, and we can look at, you can look at any ethnic group from any racial group. You could say Greeks, Italians, you can say Dominicans, you know, Mexicans, you can say Trinidadians, Jamaicans, you can say Hmong, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, right? From all over the world, people who come from other places have the ability to operate if depending on where they settle, but if they settle together and they choose to operate as a community, they will often have businesses that really, they're small businesses that really operate to serve the needs of that community, right? Like you're not going to have the need for some of the things they sell because most they're fringe needs based on the culture of that place. And those cultures have these small community businesses that typically don't raise their money from, can't get money from the government because they're immigrant communities, right? So they're fundraising within their own communities and servicing their own communities. And I guess I bring them up because I see them to me as examples of ways that things can remain sustainably. But I see that also the difference is that there are immigrant needs and like consumers who consume immigrant products that they can only get from those places. Mm-hmm. And like, cause like if you want to get that really specific cheese that they use to make, you know, quesadillas, right? Like you would usually have to go to that community. How much is our problem also that we are a part of a culture that we can't, I don't know how to put this. How much of our problem is that we are American and that we have nowhere else to go? We have no inner thing happening.
Well, you know, Olivia, I think you have really touched on one of the very, very powerful perspectives. You remember in the movie Roots, a part of the slave-making mechanism was to cut off all remembrance of where you came from. So that anything that, any roots that you had, any connections that you had to your homeland over the period of slavery was intentionally cut off. So they wanted black people to have no roots. So their only roots would be in America, where they were defined as slaves. When other people come here from other countries, that's the difference between the American black and everybody else. So when people come here from other countries, they still bring their roots with them. The black man in America, the roots were intentionally cut off, so you had no connection to anywhere. You're literally a tree without roots growing wherever the master planted you. And that is, I think, the reason for affirmative action, the social programs. That's about the uniqueness. You know, I think a part of the power to define is such an awesome power. And when people have not changed their hearts, you know, as I said, we may go through the motions of trying to be a more just and world, but if people have not really changed their hearts and their emotions, then it's just an act. Because inside, the saying is, a mind changed against its will is of the same opinion still. So if you had people who were practicing and perpetuating segregation as a result of the law now have to practice integration, they still bring the same mindset. So they still bring the same racist foundation into the equation. When we look back over all the other peoples that have come here as immigrants, black people are the only ones who were brought here and where the roots were intentionally cut so that you had no relationship to anywhere in the world. We try to reestablish that connection between ourselves and Africans of the homeland who were spared that middle passage, but it's still a stretch. It's still a stretch. So when you were sharing that, that creates a paradigm now where we are still searching for our roots. That's the whole thing about the whole roots thing. So many of us now searching for where we came from and what part of Africa and with the DNA and et cetera, because there's a deep yearning to really connect with your roots. I mean, a natural part of the evolution of a person, of a mankind, of a social group is their roots and that connection to the roots. And that was taken away from the slaves and that was never done with anybody else.
Yeah, and I guess I'm thinking about the economic implication, the economic ramifications of being cut off is the way that I, from what I see and my experience and observation is that when you have immigrant populations, you have the opportunity to constantly replenish that community with new buying power, with new yes. workers, with new people who need shoes, with new yes. people, you know, like you keep adding to that group. Or being, you could say, maintaining a certain level of need. You know what I mean? Because like, okay, if you're not obviously, if you're doing things like if you are a launderer, if you sell food, if you're a grocer, if you, you know, there are certain needs that continue, and then there are certain things that don't. Like you buy a car one time for 10 years. You know, like you don't need a bunch of them. So those. Two different kinds of models. You either have those kinds of things that you need constantly and the things mm-hmm. that you don't, but you make one big purchase and you need it one time. The black population doesn't have that kind of like growing, the black business population doesn't mm-hmm. have that growing group of people that need things, except for in certain categories.
Yes.
But most of our things that we sell are really niche needs. Hair, mm-hmm. Hair, what was the other one we were talking about? Oh, I think actually David Pickett mentioned it, funerals. Yes. Yes. And then everything else, you would have to really make an argument for people that you need to purchase from a black business person who sells that thing.
Yes.
And I think this is one of the things maybe we have to look, I think this may take another conversation because I feel like we set the groundwork here in this conversation about the emotional and psychological impacts of integration on the black mind, which is the opening of the feeling of freedom.
Yes.
I can, And you will choose freedom. You will choose the experience of freedom over security, over anything else, because it's almost a physical feeling. You know, like when you, it's like if you've been in a room all day and you go outside and you're like,
yes,
it's a mood enhancer without even really having to do very much. It's just the way it feels to have fresh air when you take your mask off your face, you know, that feeling is, people will do anything to keep that feeling.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what integration has done for consumers, is that is enhanced that feeling of freedom.
It does. And in many ways, it's a very natural thing, but it's funny how it, from the point of view of like economics, the trend, and you know, if you look at what happens to the black community, the black man, it's almost a barometer of what will happen to white people, the whole world. So when we look at how the small black businesses were virtually neutralized by integration, when you put the paradigm of racism and then you bring in integration, then people act just like trained animals. They literally, they want what they have been denied all along. And so that literally destroyed black businesses, you know. But then we look now at how the economy has grown. So now it's not so much a white-black thing. It's like a big box thing.
Mm.
So you got your big box stores that have basically eliminated small businesses, white. So the black businesses were just the first one. If you want to look at the future of this country, you look at what has happened to black folks and you follow it down the line 40, 50 years. Just as the black businesses were literally destroyed by integration, by being gobbled up by the outside economic drivers, that the small business, white, black, brown, purple, are being gobbled up by the large corporations. So just as all the black hair products companies got bought up by the Revlons of the world, the mom and pop stores get bought up or put out of business by the Walmarts and the big stores, the big box stores. And so when we look down the line, I don't know how it can ever be, well, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. That's number one. Once, as they said, who is it? The hand having written moves on. It does not come back to correct itself or to modify what was written. When we look at what is happening now with black people in America, this contradiction of concept, you know, that is there systemic racism? No, there's not systemic racism. Let's look at something else. I mean, that's, rather than deal with the issue, folks tend to look at, you know, the burning car, or the building that gets torn down, or the statue. But there has to be ways to go forward where we can resolve these things. And those ways will only be found when people seek them. So until black people and white people can say, look, we got to find a solution. We're in a ship. The ship is sinking. I don't care what we say. The ship is sinking. We got to find a solution. We got to do things together because we're all on this ship. It's a lot like global warming. We can not believe in it and whatnot, but when those hurricanes come heavier than ever before, that's a clue. That's a clue. So Ray Charles can say, Stevie, I see it.
Don't bring Stevie into this. No. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Okay. And so there are clues that are happening right now. Those, and that's why, Olivia, I really, you know, you're my daughter, but I am just super stoked about the fact that you have the awareness to see that this needs to be taken up by the young people, that what we can do is provide historical foundation, but you all are the ones who actually go into the battlefield.
Yeah, I think without more information, it's hard to get a full image of everything. But it's, I think it's really, I mean, I just read something today about the impending, first of all, the crisis that's 14% more people are hungry, or like 7 million additional children are hungry to a level at which like they would be considered a health risk. And like, you know, places like South Sudan, all over South Asia, Southwest Asia. So there's a lot of things happening when you really zoom out, but when you zoom in, you start to see that they're all a part of a similar conversation. They're all results of things happening, that these larger trends.
Yes.
And it's a very, you know, I brought that up only to say that I think that it's easy to get myopic. It's easy to get really concerned about one group and one group only. But I think if we can learn from what happened here, we can start to ask better questions in our future. And so I think we're about at time. It's 2:06. Yes. I want to thank everyone who's been here with us. There have been folks commenting, Amber, David, there were some other folks I saw as well, but they were having a very spirited discussion in the chat. We are really committed to doing this on a regular basis. Once a week, Saturdays at 1:00 p.m., the daddy-daughter dialogues. There are so many things that we want to talk about but this is just, it feels that it's very, for me, it's very pressing. And we have an opportunity right now as two people who have traveled through a lot of different kinds of, a lot of versions of America, I'll put it that way. And certainly not all of them, but many of them that we can bring some insight and some sharing, and to kind of discover new directions, new questions, and new opportunities. And I thank you all for being here with us, for hanging out with us, listening to what we've been sharing, and for sharing what your perspectives are here. We don't have all the answers, but as my mom would say, we do ask a lot of questions. So if you all are interested in continuing to connect with us, my dad wrote a book called Solving the Race Issue in America. It is out on Amazon right now. And he's actually just started. This is new. We are all like everyone else. 2020 has brought us all to a whole new life experience. And what we are interested in is asking questions that can better prepare us for the future. So there's a big table read happening on Wednesday nights with this book. I'm going to stop. I'm going to say that. And now I'm going to stop and let you say more about it, because that's really all I know.
Yes. Well, Libby, thank you so much. During the month of September, we have four, we call them discussions, on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern. There's a link on Eventbrite. Olivia, I think, is the link, and you can click on it. There's no charge for it. But we're having discussions where we're trying to give everybody a chance, one, to walk a mile in my moccasins, and I can walk a mile in your moccasins. But then to look at ways we can analyze our perspective, but then we can go forward. You know, analysis can lead to paralysis, but any analysis that does not lead to action is worthless. And so our goal over these next three, we have three more sessions. Wednesday night, go and register right away. We're going to be talking about, this time we're going to be talking about religion and the role of the church and spirituality, that the way the world is unfolding right now is a spiritual evolution. And then each week we have different topics. We post it. We have a website. It's actually a group, Solving the Race Issue Movement, Solving the Race Issue in American Movement on Amazon. But the path to get there is to click on our Eventbrite link in the post under this video. Join us Wednesday, share it with your friends, and bring your insight, because together there's a spiritual principle. When two or more gather on one accord, I am the making power, the power that changes the world is among them. And as we come together on one accord, we will change the world.
Yeah. Thank you, Libby. Awesome. Thanks, Dad. So again, like I said, if you are interested in continuing this conversation, if you want to really get down and dirty with it, like, not everybody ready to get down and dirty. Some of us just want to write posts on Facebook. Some of us just want to talk to our neighbors. Like, that's fine too, wherever you're at. But we want to be a resource for you if you're interested in engaging this at a level of dealing with it historically right now. If that's something that you're interested in, please keep connecting with us. I think I also posted, if you're interested in all the things that my dad does, transformation and insight and business and now race is a part of the repertoire. So if you're interested in connecting with us and staying, getting connected to some of the work my dad did, he has a Patreon where he has a lot of other things. If you're just interested in growing and developing as an individual, personal development, that's also there. We just love you all, and we are so committed to having an even brighter future, a better, brighter America world, a world where we can all live together and respect each other and give space to each other and see a lot of these dreams that I think we each have being realized. So thanks again, everyone. This is the Daddy Daughter Dialogue. Questions on integration. Bless, be blessed, take care. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris saying, you are tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show on Bishani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We're available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Vashani Radio and iHeart Radio.